Again, I'm Dick Buescher, and I live in Portland, work in the Forest Service, and have enjoyed a long relationship with Holden Village, and in about the last 3 years have begun to spend any time I can get out of my schedule to share some knowledge that I've acquired in some 32 years in wilderness and general management of the National Forest. Today, and this a good part of this week, I've linked together discussions on wilderness for a particular reason. This is the 25th anniversary of the Wilderness Act of September 3rd, 1964, and in September there's going to be a national celebration of that fact. And so we are nationally re-examining the value of wilderness, what it's all about, and its future. So it seemed particularly timely to do that here. The first of these, today's discussion, is going to limit itself to the roots of that act and not the act itself. That'll be tomorrow. And what its provisions are, what our experience in 25 years has been, and what some of the interesting anomalies of wilderness management is a question, but that's tomorrow. Today we're going to look at philosophy and how this all came about, because it's been a rather unique American experience. Now the approach I want to take is to share through a series of very brief quotes from the real thinkers and makers and shakers of the wilderness movement, their thoughts in a chronology that build us to the final achievement of the act in the United States. But I'm going to intersperse that with some breaks to direct questions to you, because it's going to be very valuable to me. I'm keynoting this one of three elements of this assembly in Minneapolis to celebrate the 25th anniversary, and your thoughts are going to help prep me to what I want to share with that group. So let's look first at some of the thoughts, some of the thinkers that express themselves, not always to a very popular audience, I might add, that got us on this course. One of the first, I'm sure, is familiar to many of you, and that's Thoreau. And he wrote in Walden in 1854, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." And so we already have a philosophy of the relationship of man, in his eyes, in his experience, and in his writings, with nature, in a very direct relationship. There's a coincidence to that date, I find, in the reading that I've done rather extensively on the roots of wilderness, to the same date, a very, very interesting, almost ironic counterpart, and that's Chief Seattle, who is expressing these words, and there'll be a short part of this document which has been published here at Holden, and I would strongly recommend to all of you. It's really a moving expression from the early inhabitants of the West. But Chief Seattle says, remember the same year that Walden was sitting in the East Coast in New York writing at Walden Pond, he said these words, "Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. The people did not weave the web of life, but are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves." And I think you can personalize that with some of the concerns we have with what we've done with the ecosystems of the nation and the world. And we'll talk about that some a little later. He went on to say, "Even the white people, whose God walks and talks with them as friend to friend, cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. One thing we know, which the whites may one day discover, our God is the same God. You may think now that you own God as you wish to own our land, but you cannot. God is the God of people, and God's compassion is equal for the red and the white people. The earth is precious to God, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt upon the Creator." So we have Chief Seattle on the coast western coast of the United States in Thoreau in the very same year, expressing some basic philosophy about the value of the natural world, the world unchanged by the hand of man or woman. And it's interesting to me, and I'll follow just with this one, and then I'm going to direct some questions at you that are fundamental, that along comes a Forest Service employee, and he uttered these words in 1948. They've often been quoted, or not uttered, but wrote, in a San County almanac, and of course I'm talking about Aldo Leopold. And he said, like winds and sunsets, wild things are taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a pasque flower is a right as unalienable as free speech. So in that passage of time, and I want to pick up one more series, and of course it's an individual that should be known to most of you in the writings of John Muir. John Muir really dedicated his life to wandering the West, and most particularly the places we now know as our classic national parks in California, and Yosemite and Sequoia. He was the first of the really militant environmentalists in the United States, and had a very small following, was seen to be a little bit crazy by some, but he expressed some really fantastic, I believe, thoughts about, again, the relation of man, and again, pick up on the spirituality that's in his writing relevant to nature and man's position, or mankind's position in nature. Toiling in the treadmills of life, we hide from the lessons of nature. We gaze morbidly through civilized fog upon our beautiful world, clad with seamless beauty, and see ferocious beasts and wastes and deserts. But savage deserts and beasts and storms are expression of God's power, inseparably companioned by love. And he added, but it is not in the deeps of the woods that people are soothed. But it is not in the deeps of the woods that people are soothed into perfect rest, nor in mountain valleys, however beautifully bounded by lofty walls. And you could quickly think of our situation here at Holden. One feels submerged and ever seeks the free expanse, nor yet on lofty summits, islands of the sky, but on the tranquil uplands where exhilarating air and a free, far outlook are combined with the loveliest of the flora. In that zone, below the ice and snow, and above the darkening woods, where the sunshine sleeps on alpine gardens, the young rivers flow rejoicing from the glacial caves, and the groves of eriogonums are open to the light. Perfect quietude is there, and freedom from every curable care. There couldn't have been a more accurate description written of the place that everybody walks to when they walk up this valley, and you reach the Lyman Basin and the passes and Holden Lake. It is precisely that zone that I call the High Lonesome that he describes here, and that attracts also me. And lastly, from Muir, he said, in God's wildness lies the hope of the world, the great, fresh, unblighted, unredeemed wilderness. The galling harness of civilization drops off and wounds heal ere we are aware. With that, I'd like to have you entertain and answer this question. What does wilderness mean to you? You've heard what it meant to Thoreau, to Walden, in his writing in Walden, to Muir, and to Leopold, and to Chief Seattle. How about some of you? How would you describe wilderness? What's its meaning to you?
A friend and I talk about this in terms of where we go. to put things back into perspective. And I guess that's what it does for me, is puts things back into perspective.
How about others of you? And maybe some that don't visit Wilderness, because it's very apparent it's not essential to visit Wilderness to find value in it, in its existence.
I think it has a lot of surprises. You can just sit and watch and be surprised by the bugs or butterflies or the water.
But you could do that in your backyard. Why Wilderness?
Good question.
Well, you see your backyard all the time.
There you go.
It's something new.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a new experience.
Or perhaps it's because you bother to look when you're there, and maybe you don't. And the place is familiar. Herbie.
Also, the stillness and the overwhelming quality, without all the other influences and memories.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new, fresh.
Right.
I'm always amazed. I mean, in light of the vastness and awesomeness, the smallness as well. When you see one of these incredibly small flowers that have still have like 8 petals on them, and they're probably a centimeter wide, you notice all the smallness and the beauty and the smallness in the midst of the vastness.
That's an important perception, because when you really dig into the writings, and I happen to just choose that passage from Mirror because it so well describes our situation here and really well describes what I find so particularly rewarding in the Cascade Range, where I'm so familiar, you'll find many, many references to the minutiae, those little pieces of nature that are equally important, and they're all through their writings. So it wasn't just the great picture in the great Yosemite Valley that caught his attention. Well, let's look at this a little, and then I'm going to have a more important question about Wilderness and yourselves. So what happened? We had eloquent expressions. Aldo Leopold was about most active in the 20s and 30s in the United States. And within the Forest Service, we had a voice. But prior to Aldo, we had two champions of Wilderness in the Forest Service that moved this nation toward a Wilderness system. Tomorrow's discussion. And the first of those was an interesting character. His name was Arthur Carhart, and he was in Colorado at the time. He was sent out to design a tract of summer homes in a lake yet undeveloped, Trapper Lake. And it was the vogue at the time of the Forest Service to develop summer homes so that some utility was gained from these lands that were trackless and very attractive for recreation purposes. Well, Arthur Carhart went out there and he camped on Trapper Lake, and he meditated upon his job, and he decided it was not an appropriate thing to do with Trapper Lake. And so he didn't do his task of platting a summer home area and a road to get there, and he came back and he told his superiors that. And so he was a little rebellious. He'd already rejected his assignment, and not only that, but offered another concept to leave it alone. And he played on an early message that came from Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, he was the president that gave us the National Forest to start with in 1905, along with Gifford Pinchot. And Teddy Roosevelt, when he first visited the Grand Canyon, we all remember that image of Teddy, who was the shooter of animals and the charger up San Juan Hill and the great activist. And you may not have anticipated finding wilderness philosophy in Teddy Roosevelt, but it was there. When he first viewed Grand Canyon, he had said, "Keep it as it is. You can't improve it." And so Arthur Carhart quoted the father of the Forest Service in his arguments and did pretty well, because they accepted his argument. He went on for, are some of you from Minnesota? There's always somebody from Minnesota here. Well, he went on to work in Minnesota with the Forest Service, and he gave you the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. It's Arthur Carhart's work that led directly to its classification, and later it became Wilderness. But it was an administrative classification directly as his work. Well, just about that same time, another real character occurred on or happened on the scene in the Forest Service. He was with us a very, very short time, and that was Bob Marshall. And Bob Marshall was a passionate individual, and he lived a very short life. Both he and Carhart and Leopold all died a relatively young age. But in that very short life, he visited Alaska. He was an early champion for preservation in Alaska, when we all thought that was the great frozen unknown, and were very ignorant of the potential values of Alaska, let alone its beauty. But he was a greater champion in the lower 48. And so the work of those two together, and he became the head of recreation in our national office, became the influence that established a system of wilderness within the National Forest under administrative classifications. So Bob Marshall later, incidentally, became the head of the Wilderness Society. And many, many people tend to think that the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club and many of the other environmental organizations are opponents of the Forest Service. Recognize it was the head of the Recreation and the Forest Service that originated the Wilderness Society, and I've been a life member, and many other Forest Service people are. So there are great debates about wilderness and the utility of the National Forest, but there are champions and always have been for wilderness within the Forest Service. So we began to study the National Forest lands, and decisions were made in the 20s and 30s to set aside areas just as they are. They were called primitive, and it was kind of a look before we leap decision, and was not particularly well received in the forestry profession, which tends to teach utility of the forest. And so these early efforts were seen as unwise, dangerous, foolish, wasteful, set-asides, lockups. Those were all terms commonly used within and without the profession. So let's pause at that. We find ourselves right in the midst of the creation of an administrative system, and ask yourselves this question, react to this question. Is wilderness important in your life? You've already expressed a couple of ways that you wilderness has meaning to you. Is it really important in your life? Because there are some arguments that wilderness is fine, but it isn't essential, it isn't necessary. Is it important in your lives? Is it essential, necessary? Dave?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. A young boy speaks. Why?
I think similar to the views expressed earlier, I just feel like I'm more myself out in the wilderness. I happen to like the bigness more than the smallness, but just that sense of kind of getting out of the rat race or sort of, I don't know, communing with nature, sense of creation.
Well,
climbing mountains. If anything
happens
to us, we never get it back.
Exactly.
I've done a lot of wilderness hiking, and in one sense I find it useful and necessary. It's a place I go on a hiking trip to enjoy for reasons I think have been expressed. But I'd also like to bring up another idea, which I think relates to the utility of the wilderness, that I find I derive a good deal of satisfaction and benefit from the wilderness of the world that I have never been to and realistically never will go to. The very fact that it is there, that somebody could go and photograph some of these places and write up in National Geographic or some other journal, that this place is there and it is like this and it is unspoiled, this does something for me. I find that this is very useful, very valuable, essential. So I'd like to emphasize that wilderness is important to me, even if I have no hope of being there personally.
Let me tell you that having worked for over 30 years in the politics of wilderness, that you're in a very large club. We find that the greatest majority of supporters for wilderness classification are vicarious users, not actual users. If all the people that use wilderness voted, there'd be no wilderness. If all the people that support wilderness, when all the people that support wilderness did vote, we have wilderness. So vicarious value is an important one. How much of that for some of you is spiritual? Do you make a spiritual association? What way? How would you express that?
Well, I think God's creation really comes alive in the quiet and in the beauty of all this, you know, when you're around concrete and bricks and automobiles and all that stuff, which certainly is part of God's world, but the creation of the
insignificance of a person sometimes in the relation to the whole.
Mm-hmm. Others. A lot of you reacted to that question, yes.
Mm-hmm. Makes us understand that there is a God that does control.
Mm-hmm.
The wonder of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, in one of the passages I was reading this afternoon on Mirror, it is not on Mirror. It's, in fact, I may find that one for you. He tends to, it's Bev Driver. Let me read that to you. In fact, I'll give you some of these people are friends of mine. This is a new small book that came out. It was done by the San Diego Press, and I got the last copy in existence. I called the bookstore because I'd heard about it. I'd seen a book review, and she had one copy that a student had marked up and was back in the used column, so I even got a discount. But many of these people are my contemporaries, and Bev Driver, who is not, and I know Bev very well, he happens to be a researcher at Fort Collins, Forest Service researcher at Fort Collins, Colorado. Recreation researcher. I've worked many times with Bev, and I know him well. And by the way, he's a man and not a woman. I read his stuff for 10 years, and when I met him, I was waiting to meet a woman. And Bev is a very interesting character, not one that I would accuse of being a particularly spiritual person. He never touched me that way. And here's how he wrote on the subject. He said, "I really do not care what label one puts on universal love energy, and I believe that the God of no one humanistic religion is more meritorious spiritually than the God of another. Although I respect and appreciate the social bonding force of organized religions, I feel no need to participate. My temple is my body, an expanded mind and the light within, and my preferred cathedral is a serene, natural area, wilderness or not, alone or with like-minded others. To me, every breath is a prayer, a greatly appreciated flow of life energy, and I breathe more deeply and with greater spiritual awareness in clear, rarefied air. My training in several types of meditation has something to do with these values." And so that's Bev's notion of wilderness. That reads a lot better than his research, by the way.
You maybe haven't defined wilderness quite well enough for me. Are you including the Amazon forest?
Oh, certainly.
Oh.
Yeah, right now we're talking wilderness philosophically and not the American system.
Ancient,
so any undisturbed natural environment is wilderness. And there's an interesting point. Rupert Cutler, who was our assistant secretary for a while, is an attorney, but an attorney for the Wilderness Society before he joined government, perhaps gave us the most facetious definition. Wilderness is a place where the hand of man has never set foot. I notice he uses gender-specific language, too. But that's all right. In my reading here soon, I run across the fact that someone thinks that nature is her. So it works both ways. But, definition of wilderness is, that's a highly personal thing, by the way, but dealing just with the physical. Wilderness is essentially a sufficiently large area of undisturbed natural environment. But for many, many people who live in the cities that come to our campgrounds, which I consider highly modified, they think they're in wilderness. So it's very relative. But we're really talking here about a place where nature is still in charge and we have not made modifications. If preservation of wilderness, and it seems to be a consensus that there's value in that, clearly value, there's personal value, there's spiritual value, you've shared that. Okay, we've captured the spiritual one as a proclaimed value. What other values would there be? Because we're talking about a very, very expensive allocation of our resources when we talk about wilderness. My former boss said, only a country as rich as America can afford a wilderness system. And think about that for a while. But the values that you subscribed already to wilderness are spiritual and on a highly personal basis, and that let's just say wellness of being, and that is mental as well as physical. You've given me good examples of that, Dave's example, others. Are there other values, any other values that are not in the purview of those?
Just the preservation of the human species. I mean, if you cut down the rainforest, aren't we just going to die out because of the lack of oxygen and greenhouse effect and all that business? I mean,
you're really talking about then a contribution. To all life.
Right.
Not just human species.
Right.
But of course we could do that without making it wilderness. Mm-hmm. It's just how it's being done. Mm-hmm. But wilderness would certainly achieve that. What else?
I would say the unknown values. I don't think we're always discovering something new.
Precisely. It's scientific value. And scientific because it is nature in a preserved state, unaltered. So it gives us a chance to use it as a benchmark. We do this in the Forest Service. We do research in wilderness in an unchanged state to either read the consequences of what we've done or what we might do in managing the forest or any other element in the land, including minerals. So it has scientific value. Any others that come to mind? Yes.
Well, how historic are the roots of the world? I mean, we're looking at the way it started out.
Can I call that cultural? All right. It has a cultural value. You'll find out tomorrow if you show up that three of these are named in the Wilderness Act. But very interestingly, one very important one up there was not. And I'm seeing more and more prominent discussion of that, and not to make a mystery out of it, it's a spiritual one. And a lot of that has come to my understanding by participating here at Holden. Because I worked in the legal making of wilderness all those 30 years, and I work in the management and lead the management of wilderness and in the preservation responsibility we have, I have tended to look very heavily to the three named values and was not as aware even within myself, though it has great spiritual value to me. I was not as aware of it until I started participating with groups here at Holden, and most particularly this wilderness and spirituality retreat that we do in the wintertime. There's something very special about wilderness in the wintertime. For one thing, it expands. Wilderness starts legally and actually just beyond the ball field in this valley now. And I think you realize that as you walk up there, you still see all the marks of humankind's use. But when you pass that point, it's coincident with the boundary of wilderness, but regardless of that, the world changes. And essentially, besides the trail, there's little else to tell you that anything has been changed. Well, in the winter time, wilderness starts where the road bends and goes across the bridge. It moves closer. And I see Dave nodding because he knows exactly what I'm talking about. That's the portal now. So winter changes it all. Wilderness, in effect, expands. Much of the work of humankind is eliminated by snow. Let me ask you this. Do you think that wilderness is unique to America in terms of a society embracing the concept of the need to preserve wilderness? Think of the other societies you're associated with, and some of you have been long associated, like Norman. Have other societies in the past, because I also want to ask a current question on the same thing, are you aware of any other societies that have actively, as a society and the government of that society, set aside wilderness for preservation for natural in a natural state? Anybody?
I'm not sure what you mean, but I was amazed to know that there's 300 organizations in Brazil trying to do good down there. It amazed me.
Yes.
You just think of it, there's some people down there raping the place. And
But the date of their origin may be very recent.
It may be.
Because the threat has been very recent. Anybody? Dave?
I don't know if the practice was there, but in theory, a lot of the Native American groups were, at least philosophically, were trying to live with the land.
Oh, I think clearly so. Yeah, they had no need for a wilderness system because they accepted the wilderness as it was.
Sort of the basic philosophy.
Yeah, actually, there's really nothing quite like the American phenomena. But the interesting thing is it's being exported now. I lived in Austria for 2 years in 1953, and I had the spirit of the value of wilderness in me when I went over there, and though I hadn't started my career yet, and I was struck with the idea that this was the way America should treat its mountains, that I had a high sense that the Austrians and the Germans had a sense of the fatherland, as they referred to it, that they knew the value of the earth, very much like the American Indian, tended to respect it. You didn't see litter, you didn't see abuse, you saw a lot of development in terms of guest houses and trails, wider than I'd ever seen. But a very high respect, and ski areas and gondolas, but still, a respect that we, in my view, in the United States, had not learned. Well, today the roles are reversed. First, we exported littering, waste, and all the other things in our society we're not very proud of, and we're trying to reverse. But we've now exported the concept of wilderness, and the Green Party over there is working actively to try and create wilderness to the extent they can, that they can recreate it out of highly modified mountain areas. And the same thing's happening in British Columbia, almost surreptitiously. I was asked about 5 years ago, I think, to meet with three gentlemen in Seattle. They didn't want me to come to Vancouver. I was willing because they really didn't want to have the meeting in Vancouver, BC. They wanted to get out of the country to talk about it. But they wanted counsel from myself and some others that had worked with me in the writing of the wilderness regulations for the Wilderness Act, to give them counsel on how they might approach preserving some parts of British Columbia that are still unlogged, unroaded, and undeveloped. And there is now a chapter of the several chapters of the Sierra Club in both Victoria and Vancouver, other parts of Canada, I understand.
I'm sure there is one of them.
Yes, that doesn't surprise me. And so we are exporting the wilderness concept, which is sort of curious. We tend to think of ourselves as a society that's really been very recent and well behind the development of earlier societies. This one element is an export, and perhaps a valuable one to the world. Let's listen to a couple of other people that have shared, again, people I know, who have shared different perspectives. I remember I entitled this talk, and I got to find him here, I posed a question about whether wilderness was a place or a state of mind. Let me read to you a rather eloquent expression that was popularized for quite some time in the mid-70s to the early 80s by kind of a guru of wilderness, as I like to call Roderick Nash. And he wrote this. He said, "Wilderness does not exist. It never has. It is a feeling about a place, part of the geography of the mind. In an effort to construct a workable definition, we draw lines on maps and pass complicated laws. We act as if wilderness were real, rocks, trees, canyons, mountains. But it is actually a state of mind evoked by a state of nature, a quality associated by some people with some places. This explains why the conditions under which one visits a place are so crucial to the so-called wilderness experience. It also suggests why wilderness management may be a contradiction in terms," and tomorrow we'll talk about that. So Roderick Nash, in the turn of 1970 into 80, was talking about wilderness as a place, rejected the idea, or as a state of mind, and tended to reject it as a place. When I find him here, I'll show you what he thinks today. But how do you react to that? There's been a lot of expressions here that you do see it as a place. Is it also a state of mind? I think that's right. I think that's a good point. And I think if I read all of this paper that he delivered in those times, I think you'd see that that's what he really had in mind. That in fact, wilderness was where people found it by what they had in their mind in the place they were in. Well, he's now written very currently, these words. I have argued in several publications that wilderness is a state of mind. We infuse it with meaning, recently as noted, favorable in character. But the essence of wilderness is places. So my guru has reversed himself. Creatures and forces that civilization does not control. That really is the most common definition among all of these philosophers of wilderness. The word itself derives from the Old English, will, uncontrolled, hence wild, being prefixed by dior, animal. So wilderness literally means the place of wild beasts. As such, it is a potentially dangerous place for people. It is a strange, weird, mysterious, remote, frightening, and unknown. To many, maps and guidebooks and signs and managers and yes, even wilderness lovers erode the essence, or too many, I should have said. Maps, guidebooks, and signs and managers and yes, even wilderness lovers erode the essence of wilderness. And so does the promotional Let's Have a Wilderness Experience hype. It takes some effort today to dig through the myth and, like Thoreau, find the bedrock of reality. So it is more than a state of mind. It certainly is a place.
I noticed I was in Yellowstone this year and Glacier last year, and we used to camp a lot there in, probably 20 years ago when I was growing up. And I noticed there was a big change in attitude as far as like the animals and the places that people were going. I mean, when I was a kid, the bears were toted out of away from campgrounds and stuff. And now they're allowed pretty much to wander, except they're not fed anymore. They're toting all the garbage out of Yellowstone now. I never saw one bear, and when I was a kid, I saw bears all the time. But now they don't feed the animals like they used to, so they are changing it. In Glacier, they have cages for hikers or campers to go in, whereas before they would eliminate them. And I was really shocked, because when I got to Glacier, there were all these signs, you know, saying watch out for the bear, and there were bear sightings reported, and you couldn't go on the trails, and it was just totally different, because when I was growing up, we were allowed to go anywhere, and the bears were the ones that were eliminated out of the park.
Maybe my reaction to that is, for all the time we put them in cages, maybe it's our turn.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a little bit like Kruger National Park in South Africa that was founded by Paul Kruger when he found Europeans particularly coming down and shooting just herds of animals, and they set aside this park the size of the state of Maryland. And when you're in that park, you feel like you're the outsider, because the animals, it's their country, and so you're the one that has to be caged, if you will, you know, while they are free. And it's a completely different feeling when you're in that setting.
Well, that expression is valuable in this sense that it raises this whole question of how practical is it to preserve wilderness in areas? And can we be a modern society with the demands that we have created for ourselves, for the lifestyles that we want, and still have wilderness too? When we're dealing with a species like the grizzly bear, as they are there, it's become extremely difficult. Most particularly so because the national parks have another mission. And the other mission they have is to preserve nature, which means no hunting. And that's very different than the national forests. The conservation or wise use of resources is a mission of the Forest Service. And I'll show you this in a minute. But that raises a real anomaly for the Park Service. If you don't shoot wild animals, they have a tendency not to be very wild. Exhibit A is in our lawn every morning. And they tend to lose their fear and therefore respect for people. Okay, that was exacerbated during the high development era of the national parks. And we had the big garbage dumps. And the bears, the ecosystem changed. The bears learned to depend on man's garbage. And it was really working pretty well. Until two people, and I think 1968, at the Sperry Chalet in Glacier National Park, chose to sleep on the path that the bears used to get to the garbage. That was a very unfortunate choice for the bears. For those two people, it was unfortunate because they killed them. But it was very unfortunate for the bears because it reversed the whole policy of the Forest Service. Two well-known researchers of the grizzlies, the Craigheads, who were researchers for the National Park Service at the time, quit because of the change in policy. Their whole point was, it's nice to think about the grizzlies in the wild state, but in fact, we have cultivated them to be dependent on our garbage. If we try to reverse them back to the wild state, we're not going to like the consequences. And you just described the consequences. So there is a real irony. When you're dealing with grizzlies, when you're dealing with African herds with enormous ranges and really bad table manners like the elephants, there is some idealism that may not be easily, if at all, attainable in the preservation of natural worlds. And tomorrow we're going to talk about that management challenge in very specific terms in the law that set it all up. But to give you some perspective and sort of set up for that, for those of you that want to participate, you've got the U.S. Forest Service, which is my outfit, and the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, federal, all these are federal, and the Bureau of Land Management. Let me shorten that one, as everybody does. Those are the major managers of the public lands that have been set aside. This one, 1905, though first, June 4th, 1897, that's when the forest reserves were established. Now, there's a reason I remember that date. It's my birthday. Understand, not the year. But in 1905, they were converted by Teddy Roosevelt in a select piece of maneuvering into the National Forest. And we were transferred to the Department of Agriculture. So realize here you're dealing with USDA. Up until that time, the forest reserves were in Interior. So the reason they went to agriculture, the mission that we got, which was essentially wise use. And that was influenced heavily by German forestry, because there were no foresters in the United States at the turn of the century. Gifford Pinchot, as many of you know, went over to Germany, learned forestry, German style, and brought it back. And so the utility of the forest, protection and wise use, I should put, because this was the time of the timber baron and the uncontrolled grazing and the rip-offs by miners and all the rest. And so protection and wise use, but utility was the foundation of every forestry school in this United States, and that's what they taught. They didn't teach wilderness. They didn't teach social values. They taught utilities. Well, Muir's work and many others like him led to the creation of the national parks and a National Park Service to manage them. The dates for some of the parks go back into the 1800s, but the Park Service actually didn't get a mandate until 1916, and its mandate is essentially preservation of the natural world for everything in the park. And then the difficult second task is public enjoyment. And those often find themselves at odds, exactly as you described, in Glacier and in Yellowstone, and of course in Yosemite.
You have a sexual
one. Put a nail in there.
Where am I? Oh, public. How about that? Freudian slip.
What's that under in the government department?
And that is, thank you, that's USDI. Department of Interior, so is this, and curiously, so is this. Because the mandate, which was just done in the 70s, the BLM had no Organic Act. They were essentially the collection agency for everything that was left over. If it didn't become a park, a forest, national forest, or a National Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and of course their job and mandate, and I don't know the date of their Organic Act, is preservation of wildlife habitat. And the great fight in Alaska right now over oil drilling rights is in one such habitat. And they have immense areas of land. So in Alaska. So the BLM got everything that was left over and had no mandate. They now have one. And guess what? Part of the mandate is to study BLM lands and recommend to Congress for additions to the wilderness system. And again, we'll see that tomorrow. So you've got four major players when you talk about wilderness in the United States. The origin of wildernesses came with Forest Service. Park Service was very unfriendly to being included in the mandate because they saw it as a redundancy at best. Their whole feeling was they already had a preservation mandate and that wilderness would place constraints on their management alternatives. And so they were not an enthusiastic supporter. But it was also at the time that the Park Service was being driven by forces of development. And that's the big lodges were being developed, the road access. Now, they're strongly embracing wilderness and the wider ecosystem approach because the public forces are now pushing away from development and it's their inclination now to get the automobile out of Yosemite to deconstruct much of the improvements that were made in the national parks so they can get back to preservation. So they tend to go through a sine curve of impact or change over time. The Forest Service is battered at all times by force vectors that come from everywhere. You're cutting too many trees, you're not cutting enough trees, there are too many constraints on mining, there are not enough constraints on mining, and so on it goes. And so we just kind of go along in a very slow and conservative course and try to make wise decisions and learn as we go. So they're very different politics. The BLM's politics are similar to ours, except that they had no preservation mission and now they're really being pushed very heavily toward one. Fish and Wildlife Service has the cleanest mission. They essentially will keep all of us out if that's what's good for the animals. So they can make very simple decisions. And they do that regularly. Parts of the wilderness system now are the rocks off the Oregon coast. And they're bird habitat refuges, and you can't go there, neither can I. In fact, I helped them stop people from going there from blowing a chunk of rock off that was providing access. So the four agencies have different missions. But the fundamental goal is still the same, and that's to give this United States a valuable, permanent, protected system of natural ecosystems for all the values that you collectively share. It's not an easy task, folks. Your grizzly bear is only one example. Wednesday, I believe it is, I'm going to do a segment on in the evening at 6:50 on the natural role of fire, and I have a large collection of slides from the Yellowstone experience because that's so current in everybody's mind and that focused it into the public debate. But it's really an absorbing question. It's another one of those questions. Yes, we want wilderness. Yes, we see the values. And they're the four multiples that we saw and they're highly personal and spiritual for many of us. But are they possible? Because like wild animals, wildfire is an absolute essential to the preservation of wilderness. It's an absolute essential.
And your big boss doesn't agree with you,
does he? Well, yes, the Lord does agree with you. Yes, she does.
We were at Grand Canyon last year and just talk about public enjoyment. I think the Park Service runs great, or at least that was the ranger we had at Park Service.
That's right. That's National Park.
They were talking about this issue in regard to every year it's like an extra 500,000 people are coming to the Grand Canyon. They're debating that whole issue of is our cutoff point because of the overuse and mm-hmm. what is and when does it stop becoming enjoyable when there's so much use of a particular place and what is the boundary and what's the cutoff line. And it was amazing, just one thing that they threw out was we took a quarter mile hike and they said you're the 3% of the population that comes to this place. Because a recent survey has shown that 97% of the people that come there don't go farther than 200 yards from their car.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah.
They come and take a picture and then leave. And,
let me close our discussion with two quotes from a real fine mover of the wilderness movement who just happens to be from Minnesota, and Sigurd Olson, and a great champion along with his wife, and because he captures the it really puts a cap on this whole discussion of the philosophy of wilderness, for me at least, and I think it will for you. And then we, those that would want to and hang around, want to hang around and talk a little more, we can. But think about these words. We are trying to bridge the gap between our old racial wisdom, our old primeval consciousness, the old verities, and the strange conflicting ideologies and beliefs of the new era of technology. It is here that wilderness will play its greatest role, offering this age a familiar base for explorations of the soul and the universe itself. By affording opportunities for the contemplation of beauty and naturalness, as well as further understanding of the mysteries of life in an ecologically stable environment, it will inculcate reverence and love and show the way to humanism, in which man becomes at last an understanding and appreciative partner with nature in the long evolution of mind and spirit. And then a very short one. Not only has wilderness been a force in molding our character as a people, but its influence continues and will, if we are wise enough to preserve it on this continent, be a stabilizing power as well as a spiritual reserve for the future. And I think Sigurd probably said it as well as anybody can. Those were the prime motivating factors that galvanized an enormous political public support to create wilderness when all the invested dollars of industry that had an interest in those same lands fought to keep it from happening. That was an 8-year struggle, one of the longest legislative periods for a significant act dealing with natural resource decisions, and an absolutely fascinating legislative history. I participated in it, and as so many did. And it's quite a story. And then the content of the act itself is the closest thing to poetry you'll find in any law this land ever passed. And lastly, we'll deal with very specific questions of the anomalies that we, the managers, face to meet that preservation task. So we'll do that tomorrow, I think, at 6:50 for those of you who'd like to participate. Thank you very much for your thoughts. I appreciate it.